The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now, what I would suggest, you may want to take the back page off of this lecture, and you may want to pull it off, or certainly turn to that, and I'll probably read through the lecture pretty rapidly, but you want to follow this map. This map comes out of the inner cover of Trice Thompson's Presbyterians of the South. And so it is a map specifically of the South, and of the places where the church was planted. In that first paragraph, I follow Thompson, and he's following someone else, actually, in the middle of that paragraph. First, there is what we may call the Chesapeake Society, which, as the name implies, was the region around the Chesapeake Bay in both Virginia and Maryland. Secondly, there was an entirely different settlement that took place in what may be called the Carolina Lowlands, with Charleston as the central city. Third, a later development was what is known as the backcountry of the South, which stretched from the Potomac south to Georgia along the Appalachian chain of mountains, including the Piedmont to the east of the Blue Ridge and the Valley of Virginia, which lies between the Blue Ridge and the Allegheny Mountains. We shall sketch the beginnings of Presbyterianism in each of these areas. One, the early colonial period in the Chesapeake Society. Chesapeake Society was the oldest, though the Virginia Company's charter prescribed that the word and services of God be preached, planted, and used according to the rites and doctrines of the Church of England, the control of the company was in the hands of the Puritans until the revocation of the charter in 1624. The Puritans opposed the Anglican prayer book, and many favored Presbyterianism. All the ministers brought to Virginia prior to 1624 were apparently Puritan in sympathy. With the assumption of a royal control of the colony in 1624, an act of conformity was passed, and during the early 1640s, should say early there, because once that has taken place, that the revolution takes place, there is a change. While the Puritans in England were rising in the revolt against Charles, Governor William Berkeley, determined to hold them down in Virginia, sought to enforce conformity to the Church of England. This resulted in the departure of a number of colonists to Maryland at the invitation of Governor William Stone. They settled in Anne Arundel, Charles, and Prince George counties near the present city of Annapolis. Now, that's very interesting to think about, because Maryland, of course, we think of as a Roman Catholic colony, but you can see the psychology there. They recognized the Puritans were on the upswing. They recognized they might have some revocation of their policies in their colony and so forth, and so they opened themselves up to allow a freedom of religion in the state of Maryland, or in the colony of Maryland. You'll pick up at the bottom of the page, the very last footnote there, that Richard Warfield, the ancestor of B.B. Warfield, one of America's greatest Presbyterian theologians, came to this region during this period in 1659. We used to know just where the house was, not very far from the Severn River. The house has been torn down in recent days. It was just a plain frame house. But we would point that out. That's Richard Warfield's house. We knew that house when I first lived in Maryland. I have a tie to that family. My father was interested in picking that sort of thing up. During the period of the Commonwealth in England, the Puritans of Virginia were unmolested. That is, you see, once the Commonwealth was in place, the Puritans were unmolested. A number of Scottish settlers came during the 17th century who settled along the Elizabeth River near the present Norfolk. Others settled along the Rappahannock, James, and Potomac rivers. Francis McCamey, and I pronounce it the way I was taught, so if you'll understand, it's the same man we've been talking about on another pronunciation. Francis McCamey ministered in 1684 along the Elizabeth River. Not only was he on the eastern shore, but he was also along the Elizabeth River as well. His successor was Josiah Mackey, who ministered in this area until his death in 1716. Though no further record is found for a century, Benjamin Porter Grisby, a missionary touring Virginia, found a group of Presbyterians there in 1801. The First Presbyterian Church of Norfolk traces its origins back through this group to the early Puritans of Virginia. And I think, Sam, your first Presbyterians were among those earliest colonies in Virginia rather than New England. McCamey's main labors were on the eastern shore of Virginia and Maryland. He's sometimes known as the father of Presbyterianism because of the leadership in organizing the first presbytery in the colonies. This was the Presbytery of Philadelphia, although it may not have been called that. It was the General Presbytery that met at Philadelphia. They just called it the General Presbytery. But it met at Philadelphia, and in Philadelphia, as you think about the colonies, it was the central city of the colonies, though it was in a sense almost the capital of the colonies. It was a natural place. I mean, he was in the South, and yet he goes to Philadelphia for the founding of this presbytery for the geographic center. At a very small beginning, there were four ministers from Maryland: McCamey, Hampton, McNish, and Taylor, two from Delaware, Wilson and Davis, and one from Philadelphia, Andrews. That's interesting. Nothing mentioned about New Jersey. We saw a church at Lawrenceville that was dated earlier than that presbytery today. Possibly they weren't in. The Fairfield Church, and by the way, if some of you are at the PCA assembly and want to hear Paul Saddle preach, he'll be preaching at the Fairfield Church in the southern tip of New Jersey, which is 300 years old, in the PCA at Fairton, New Jersey. You could go down there for that service, and I understand they'll have a bus and so forth for transportation for that. Other Presbyterian ministers in the colonies did not associate themselves with the presbytery. The majority of the New York and New Jersey Puritan preachers remained aloof for some time. That Fairton Church was a Puritan colony sent to a congregational colony sent down from New England, though it does appear in the early records of the presbytery, and so it's been thought, Larry Rolfe, who's ministered there, thought that they ought to be counted as probably one of the first presbytery, members of the first presbytery. Joseph Mackey of the Elizabeth River was known to the presbytery, being mentioned in its minutes in 1712 as laboring with under great difficulties, but never seems to have joined himself to the presbytery. Now, the second area is the Carolina lowlands down near Charleston, South Carolina, as you look at your map. Farther south, there was a settlement of Presbyterians around Charleston, South Carolina, settled in 1670, which had no relationship with the Presbytery of Philadelphia. The earliest records of Reformed worship in that area are from the French Huguenots. The last will and testament of a certain César Mosey reveals that there must have been a French church in Charleston as early as 1687. There were also a goodly number of Scots, Dutch, and New England Puritans in South Carolina. An independent church, sometimes called Presbyterian, was formed in Charleston around 1690, composed of various peoples, French, Scots, Scotch-Irish, and New Englanders. A whole colony of New Englanders moved to South Carolina to found a congregational church at Dorchester in 1696, and then in the next century, between 1752 and 71, much of this group transplanted itself to Liberty County, Georgia, and established the Midway Church there. From this congregational church, a large number of young men were fed into the ministry of various denominations. The Presbyterians received some 30 men out of that church into its ministry, including Thomas Goulding, first professor at Columbia Seminary, and Daniel Baker, the great evangelist to the Old Southwest. An independent Scottish church was established in Savannah, which still exists as the Independent Presbyterian Church of Savannah, using ministers from the Presbyterian Church U.S. and being very closely allied to this denomination, but because of a very unfortunate experience they had with their last minister, they are now looking at the PCA for their supply. I hope they'll find somebody that suits them. Its grant of land from George II states that it is to be used for such as are or shall be professors of the doctrines of the Church of Scotland agreeable to the Confession of Faith. An independent presbytery developed in the Charleston area, which George Howe, historian of the Presbyterian Church in South Carolina to 1850, dates from 1728. That's, in other words, the presbytery began around 1728. This presbytery apparently required subscription to the Westminster Confession of Faith. Though no records of the presbytery are extant, there are letters regarding the Reverend Josiah Smith, who was excluded about 1739 because of his refusal to subscribe. The independent church of Charleston divided in 1731, with the strict Presbyterians forming the first Presbyterian church of that city. Presumably, this was over the question of subscription, though the issue of polity may also have contributed to the division. The old Charleston Presbytery passed out of existence at the time of the Revolution. there was a communication from a presbytery of South Carolina addressed to the Synod of New York and Philadelphia in 1770 relative to the possibility of uniting with the Synod. Answer was given, but no further word from the presbytery is recorded. Howe believed this was the old Charleston Presbytery. Following the breakup of this presbytery at the time of the Revolution, it was revived in 1790 and approached the General Assembly, and I think something's missing here, about relations probably, and they're in the records of 1800, 1804, 1811. For some reason, the presbytery did not want to be a part of the Synod of the Carolinas, and no union was consummated. This revived presbytery was apparently too weak to be able to continue its independent existence and soon passed from sight. The First Presbyterian Church of Charleston remained independent until 1882, when it joined the Presbytery of Charleston of the Presbyterian Church in the United States. This independency of spirit reflected in the Charleston-Savannah area has been characteristic of much Southern thought. No doubt it was forced on the early Presbyterians of this Southern region simply by their distance from the rest of the American Presbyterians. But it was to leave a mark on the South Carolina Presbyterian mind. The people of this same area were to disagree with their brethren in 1837-38. That's the old school, new school split. And thus formed, they didn't go into the new school church, they formed the independent Presbyterian denomination. They just formed their own presbytery there, again, an independent Presbyterian church, which went on its own way until the war between the states overshadowed their differences and brought about a union with other Southern Presbyterians. Two additional Presbyterian groups in the Carolina lowlands deserve mention. There was a Scotch-Irish settlement in 1732 at Williamsburg, South Carolina. It was called a Scotch Puritan community in the midst of a more easygoing English community. Farther north in 1732, the Scotch Highlanders settled in Cape Fear River area. Now, let's see, yes, he has Cape Fear River running down out of Wilmington in North Carolina. Fayetteville is the center, more or less, of this group. By the Revolution, 12,000 Highlanders were in this area. This was the largest Highlander settlement in the colonies. They held to the Solemn League and Covenant, and many were loyalists during the Revolution. Now, it was said last night the Presbyterians were by and large on the side of the Revolution. I think that's true, particularly the Scotch-Irish. But these Highlanders held a different view. A very interesting story is told about the Battle at King's Mountain, that all the men on that field were Americans except a couple of British officers. In other words, they were the Tories and those on the side of the Revolution, and they were all Presbyterians, virtually. And one of the men in John Neville's church has a good talk, and he says, here are Presbyterians who held to their convictions and were willing to die for them. And he holds that up to the fact that, you know, we Presbyterians have that sort of a viewpoint about life. And this is the way it was at there at the Battle of Scotch, of the King's Mountain, that they were virtually all Presbyterians on that field. The Patriots did win in that battle, but they were virtually all Presbyterians on both sides. Now the back country, the back parts, and here's a definition as given by the man listed at the bottom of the page. Back parts consisted of an irregularly shaped area running southwest from the Mason and Dixon's line for more than 600 miles to just beyond the southern banks of the Savannah River, and varying from 20 to 160 miles in width. Beginning west of the Monocacy River with Frederick County, Maryland, it included the Great Valley, that's the Valley of Virginia, and that portion of the Virginia Piedmont west of a line from Charlottesville due south to North Carolina boundary, as well as the North and South Carolina Piedmonts between the fall line, that is the fall of the rivers, and the Great Smokies. He's just referring to the whole Appalachian Ridge as the Great Smokies there. In extent, this was the largest territory from the Chesapeake and the Carolina countries combined. You look at that. I drove up that very road. There's a book, a very interesting book called The Great Philadelphia Wagon Road. It's in print now. And it talks about the Scotch-Irish that came into Philadelphia, went west of the Susquehanna, turned south and went down the Valley of Virginia, turned out at Roanoke rather than going up on the plateau, and came down to the Piedmont and all the Piedmont of North Carolina, South Carolina, all the way to Augusta. And this man traces all sorts of interesting things in that account and that story of that road, and it's well worth your looking at. But as I say, I drove that road, reversed it, coming up here on this trip. Before 1730, the backcountry was virtually unsettled. By the Revolution, more than 250,000, largest settlement of Scotch-Irish, were settled there. Approximately 200,000, or one-third of the entire population of Ireland, left during 1725 to 1768. 30,000 came between 1771 and 73. By the Revolution, 500,000 Scotch-Irish were in America, and it was one-sixth of the whole population. You can see why the impact of Presbyterians in this country. There were three main streams of the Scotch-Irish, through New England and New York, through Charleston and South Carolina, by Williamsburg, as we mentioned a moment ago, and the great mass via the Delaware River or Newcastle, or at Newcastle or Philadelphia. The first Presbyterian minister to settle in the Carolina backcountry was William Robinson, New Side, in 1742. John Thompson, Old Side, visited Presbyterians in Iredell County, North Carolina, that's Salisbury, North Carolina, somewhat north of Charlotte, in 1751. So you have both sides visiting in that area. Now, the Adopting Act, we've talked about that. Let me skip over, since my time is so limited. I've got here the text of some of the preliminary act in this, bottom of page 4. And then that in 1736, an overture of the Committee Upon the Supplication of the People, this was their reaffirmation of it, that the Synod do declare that inasmuch as we understand that many persons of our persuasion, both more lately and formerly, have been offended with some of the expressions or distinctions in the first or preliminary act of our Synod, contained in the printed paper relating to our receiving or adopting the Westminster Confession of Catechisms, that in order to remove said offense and all jealousies that have arisen or may arise in any of our people's minds on occasion of said distinctions and expressions, the Synod doth declare that the Synod have adopted and still do adhere to the Westminster Confession, Catechisms, and Directory without the least variation or alteration and without regard to said distinctions. We do further declare that this was our meaning and true intent in our first adopting of the said confession, as may particularly appear by our adopting act, which is as follows, and then they quote the adopting act. R.C. Reed of Columbia Seminary said there has been no greater day in the history of the church than that day when it flung this banner to the breeze and proclaimed itself a witness-bearing church. Having thus declared herself, the church might be assumed to have embarked upon smooth sailing, but such was not the case. A controversy arose that was to divide the church in 1741 between the Old Side and the New Side. Again, let me pass over most of that. Let's pick up the bottom quote there. Hodge says, "It appears from this history that the Great Schism was not the result of conflicting views." And this is where I would differ somewhat with what Dr. Barker said between orthodoxy and revivalism. I think it really is more conflict upon good order or strict order or loose order. Now, we've got that in the PCA right now. Some who would rather apply the Book of Church Order much more loosely, and some who say, no, it's Constitution, this is where you are. And I think this is what the real issue was. And frankly, though I'm a son of the New Side, because Samuel Davies brought the gospel to my own family in Virginia, he was a New Sider, I think the New Side acted very unbecomingly in their behavior. I mean, what they would do is simply go in and preach to the congregation when the minister wasn't there without any permission, without any invitation, and they'd stir that congregation against their own minister. That was reprehensible sort of conduct, and I think there is no question that they deserved being censured by the church at large, and they didn't want to be censured, so they walked. But you see, Hodge is saying that it's not conflicting views. The fact is, both of the churches adopted the same basic standards again, and they came back in 1758, as Dr. Barker pointed out, reaffirming it without any great debate over what they were adopting. They reaffirmed the Adopting Act. Let me move on to page 7, because I think you're getting some interesting things here. We talked about the Log College, visited that site today. College was founded by William Tennant, for the education of his own sons, Gilbert, William Jr., John, and Charles. Others who attended were Samuel Blair, John Blair, Samuel Finney, William Robinson, whom we just mentioned, John Rowland, Charles Beatty, Samuel Davies did not go to the Log College, but went to the next academy, Alexander McWhorter, Alexander Cumming, and James Waddell. In a very real sense, the Log College is the forerunner of the College of New Jersey at Princeton, which was established in 1746. Now, the Fags Manor Academy and that church is part of the PCA. And that, by the way, is also a church you may want to go to, just if you want to continue a historical survey this week. Go down there. It's between Oxford and Westchester. I was down there last Sunday morning, and I think you'd find a good welcome and a good congregation, a very vital young adult congregation, and here's an old established church. One of the most important daughter academies of the Log College, especially as it related to the planting of Presbyterians in the South, was that at New Londonderry or Fags Manor, Chester County, Pennsylvania. Samuel Blair was the founder of this academy. After his death, his brother John continued the work. This school was particularly significant in the development of Presbyterianism in the South. We shall review briefly the work of several of the prominent men. Now, here you have the description by Samuel Blair of what happened when he started preaching there. Our Sabbath assembly soon became large. Many people from all parts around were very much to come where there were such appearances of the divine presence and power. I think there was scarcely a sermon or lecture preached here through that whole summer, but that there were manifest evidences of impressions on the hearers. And many times the impressions were very great in general. Several would be overcome and fainting, others deeply sobbing, hardly able to contain themselves, often others crying out in the most dolorous manner. Many others were silently weeping, and solemn concern appeared in the countenance of many others. And sometimes the soul exercises of some, though comparatively but few, would so far affect their bodies as to occasion some strange, unusual bodily motions. Now, he doesn't necessarily approve of that, but he's just describing what happened. He established this academy. It grew rapidly under him, became the source of an indescribable blessing at that time, and also sent forward influences that extended very widely and have not ceased even yet. That was written in 1889. Among the graduates, Samuel Davies, who's the apostle to Virginia, Alexander Cumming, John Rogers, James Finley, and Hugh Henry. And they also mentioned somebody else that took the gospel to the West from that academy. That academy, I think, in some ways more significant than Log College. Log College started it, but that academy poured the men out into the church. Robert Smith, graduate of Fags Manor, married to the sister of Samuel Blair, found Pekka, as I understand is the way they say that, Pekka Academy, graduates of Pekka, John Caldwell, who settled in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina. Robert Smith was the father of Samuel Stanhope Smith, first president of Hampton-Sydney College and later president of the College of New Jersey. William Robinson, trained at the Log College, became an itinerant preacher like a bright meteor. He swept over the land, blazing in the light of God wherever he went. Through the sparsely settled regions of Pennsylvania, away to its western forest, through the whole of New Jersey, Delaware, and Maryland, down the Great Valley of Virginia, and over the Blue Ridge region, through Albemarle and Augusta, and other counties of the same state, through many of the larger towns of North Carolina, he hastened to the Indians, wherever he could find them, to terrified settlers flying from the butchery of savages, to noisy gatherings of Negroes. He pressed with the tidings of salvation. In 1743, he was invited to Hanover, where he began preaching on four successive days. An eyewitness account says there is reason to believe there was as much good done by those four sermons as by all the sermons preached in these parts before or since. John Blair, brother of Samuel, served at Fags Manor for 9 years and then at Princeton to serve as acting president until John Witherspoon came. Now, John Blair went into the South as well, and I think I have that dealt with more a little bit later, but started the churches around Lexington. And when I was coming up to be involved in the reception of Fags Manor and stopped by my cousin's house at Lexington, and I said something about going to Fags Manor, she said, "Well, John Blair from that church started our church, the Timber Ridge Church, just north of Lexington. And he was most influential in the valley." Samuel Davies may be properly called the father of Southern Presbyterianism, since his labors brought about the establishment of the mother presbytery of the South, namely Hanover Presbytery. He labored out off and on in Virginia from 1747 to 1759 and convened, and this is the reason he's given this title, the first meeting of the Presbytery of Hanover on December the 3rd, 1755, at the direction of the Synod of New York. The effect of his ministry was diffused over all of Virginia and North Carolina. He held the Westminster Confession and Catechisms in the highest esteem, and it was his regular practice to teach the Shorter Catechism to all his members and to have it recited at the worship services on Sunday. He would begin with the ruling elders. He would move down through their families. He'd move all the way down to the black slaves, catechizing all of them. He was interested in all of the people. And I think you talk about whether you have strict subscription or not. I mean, regardless, he believed in the teaching of the catechism. Nottingham Academy, which is just a little further on down the road as you go down US 1 below Oxford towards Baltimore, Samuel Finley was born in Northern Ireland, 1715, Scottish descent, came to America at 19, attended the Law College, licensed in 1740, served as an evangelist in New Jersey. At 29, in 1744, accepted the call to Nottingham, Maryland, a church later served by A.A. Hodge. Archibald Alexander describes the academy he established. In this place, he instituted an academy with view chiefly of preparing young men of the gospel ministry. This school was conducted with admirable wisdom and success, and it acquired a higher reputation than any other in the Middle States, so that students from a distance were attracted to it. Some of the most distinguished men in our country laid the foundations of their eminence and usefulness in this academy. At one time, there's a cluster of such young men who were all afterward distinguished, and some of them among the very first men in the country, as the following names will show: Governor Martin of North Carolina, Dr. Benjamin Rush of Philadelphia, which he was, the lady mentioned him last night here in Philadelphia, the Reverend James Waddell of Virginia, Governor Henry of Maryland, the Reverend William Tennant of Abingdon, Pennsylvania. Not be easy in any country to find such a constellation in one school at the same time. 1761, Samuel Finley was elected to the presidency of Princeton. One of the things that's striking to me, Claire, is the way in which when the College of New Jersey was founded, all of these academies seemed to have folded up. I think these men were all supporters of the academy, or the college, and therefore they saw no further need of the college of their academies, and they just put all their efforts into the college. Now, I'm just about finished on the time that I want to spend on this, but notice what I've tried to do. The church in the South, the Valley of Virginia, I've already talked a little bit about the fact that you have John Craig in 1740 at the Tinkling Springs Church, which, by the way, later Dabney was pastor of and actually drew the plans for and built the sanctuary. They're very proud of that particular church because of that. And very close to that church is the church, and that's, he's old school, is the New School group of men or of churches that John Blair, from in the middle of our third or second full paragraph of page 10, John Blair, the Timber Ridge Church, which was where Archibald Alexander was raised and taught the faith. That church had an academy associated with it called Liberty Hall Academy, which later became Washington College, which later became Washington and Lee University. That's William Grimm, who was taught by John Witherspoon, taught Archibald Alexander. Archibald Alexander, after he was converted at Hampton Sydney, came back into Lexington and sat at the feet of William Grimm, who taught several theologians, including the Moses Hogue that I mentioned as having died here in Philadelphia last night in visiting Archibald Alexander, pastoring at that time the Third Church. And then the Eastern Virginia, restated again, the founding of Hanover Presbytery. You see, the Valley and Eastern Virginia were being settled by Presbyterians at the same time. But it so happened that Davies organized the first presbytery earlier in Eastern Virginia. I was telling my cousin again, I was saying that in a way, Lexington Presbytery could have been the first one. She said, that's true. But the fact is that the first one was the Hanover Presbytery, which is near around the Richmond area. The Carolinas on page 11 again, I've tried to follow through the fact that you have various different people, particularly going to Mecklenburg County, which is the Charlotte area. Now, people in this area don't seem to know anything about it, but everybody in the South knows about the Mecklenburg Declaration. The Scotch-Irish proceeded to give a declaration that they did not recognize King George as king. They were beyond his domain. I don't think they saw themselves in revolution. They simply declared George is not does not have dominion. In fact, as he said, he didn't have dominion beyond the mountains. And so they declared that prior to the Declaration of Independence here in Philadelphia. And I think that there's good reason to believe that that declaration was genuine and so forth. Now, let me just call your attention to the last things in this higher education. I've mentioned William Graham again on the bottom of page 13 and the number of colleges, which is about 60% or about two-thirds of the colleges in the South at by the time of the war between the states were all established by Presbyterians. And so that's the first paper I've got. Now we go with the second one. While we're passing out this next one, do you all have questions or anything that you want to ask about? You can just take care of getting those out to everybody.
Samuel Davis, did he write hymns?
He wrote one hymn that is in our book.
Which one is that? It's a famous hymn.
You catch me and I'm
doing...
Pardoning
God.
Yes. Pardoning God, yes. And at least that one. Now, he's the one man of that group, at least, that I know of. Now, there may have been others, but of the Southern Presbyterians of this earlier period, he had three volumes of his sermons published. And they were published both in America and in the British Isles. And you still get those three volumes on occasion in used bookstores.
Is there any biography of him currently available?
Somebody has done a doctoral dissertation not so long ago about him. One of the best sources that I've cited him in here for biography on a good many of these men is William Henry Foote's Sketches of Virginia. Foote was a home missionary who moved about the states of Virginia and North Carolina in the mid-1800s and gathered the stories from the families about the early periods. And he's gathered things that are simply cannot be documented sometimes by any other source than Foote. But it's something of an original source. You'll find him listed in the footnotes there.
We'll show a couple
things. Okay, well, I've got one more here. On the back of this paper, I have put a chart taken out of some book, and I don't know which book right now. I perhaps should have acknowledged it. The first lines on the left-hand side of this chart, as you look at it, are you can't read, but the first, what you ought to write in there, the first presbytery, 1706, the first synod, 1717, the adopting act, 1729. They all come before that old side, new side. Separation that we've been talking about.
Can you give us those again?
The first presbytery, 1706. First synod, 1717. Adopting act, 1729. They would be lines that would run up from the left-hand edge of this darkest line. I have tried to put in at least the latest things with regard to the PCA and the PCUSA, where you have the unions and so forth there. They're probably the Bible Presbyterian Church. I haven't gotten the most recent division that has taken place there.
Read those three one more time, please.
First Presbytery, 1706. Okay. First Synod, 1717. Adopting Act, 1729. All right, now as we look at the old school, new school split material, I've got more material, certainly more than we can cover. But let me try to cover it very quickly if I can, and there'll be more blocks of this material that I can skip over, I think. What I have tried to do in this, having to prepare for this, I've been driven, in a sense, back more fully to the original sources than I have before. And so I've actually given you the text, for example, of the Plan of Union. As was talked about the other day, some of the earliest Congregationalists in Connecticut were really virtually Presbyterians. And we talked about that fact that the Connecticut churches had the Saybrook platform, and they, after the Revolution, and here you are, here's New England and New York, and they're going to go west. All that country suddenly been opened up with the French being removed and the British being removed. You got Western New York and all of what we'd call the Northwest Territory. They had the concept, and it's a beautiful concept. Look at the first indented paragraph. This was the preface to the Plan of Union of 1801. Regulations adopted by the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in America and the General Association of the State of Connecticut with a view to prevent alienation and to promote union and harmony in those new settlements which are composed of inhabitants from these bodies. So, somebody moves from New England to an area, and you only have 10 families there, and these are Congregationalists, and here's a couple of Presbyterians move in. Worship together. Of course we'll worship together. And then they laid down, you see, how they were going to do it, how they would work it out, and developed a congregation made up of these two elements. Now, if you get down to the, say, the second or third principles, let's look at the third and fourth principles. If a Presbyterian church shall settle a minister of congregational principles, that church may still conduct their discipline according to Presbyterian principles, excepting that if a difficulty arise between him and his church, or any member of it, the cause shall be tried by the association to which the said minister shall belong. Here's a Presbyterian church with a congregational minister, and if he gets in discipline, his case trial is not going to go back to Presbytery, it's going to go back to the association, you see. Otherwise, provided both parties agree to it, it says, otherwise, by a council, one half congregationalists and other Presbyterians mutually agreed upon. So here you get a group. It can be sent back to the association. But if they don't want to send it back to the association, who judges the case? A party, a council made up of what? You're not even told whether they're men or women. Not told whether they ordained people or not. Just a council, half of which will be congregationalists, half will be Presbyterians. You can see how totally unconstitutional that is from a Presbyterian perspective. And this is one of the provisions. And the fourth one, if any congregation consists partly of those who hold the congregational form of discipline and partly of those who hold the Presbyterian form, we recommend to both parties that this be no obstruction to their uniting in one church and settling a minister. And that in this case, the church choose a standing committee from the communicants. A standing committee from the communicants, any of them, you see, doesn't have to be elders, whose business it shall be to call to account every member of the church who shall conduct himself inconsistently with the laws of Christianity, and to give judgment on such conduct. That if the person condemned by their judgment be a Presbyterian, he shall have a liberty to appeal it to the presbytery. If he be a Congregationalist, he shall have a liberty to appeal it to the body of the male communicants of the church. In the fore case, the determination of the presbytery shall be final unless the church shall consent to a further appeal to the synod or to the general assembly. And in the latter case, if the party condemned shall wish for a trial by a mutual council, the cause shall be referred to such a council. And provide the standing committee of any church shall send one of themselves to attend the presbytery. He may have the same right to sit and act in presbytery as a ruling elder of the Presbyterian Church. You see what it's saying? Person from a congregationalist background, congregationalist, can be sent to a presbytery, and what's it agreed to? That he can sit in that court. He's never subscribed to anything. Congregationalists didn't have any adopting act, did not subscribe. And here you had this very thing developing. That's exactly what developed then. That this was a well-intended plan is generally conceded, but it certainly involved a compromise of the principles upon which the Presbyterian Church was based. For example, in churches composed of both Congregationalists and Presbyterians, the biblical office of elder, which both the Saybrook Platform of Connecticut and the Presbyterian form of government demanded, was set aside for a standing committee of persons who were subjected to no examination, no pledge or subscription, either to the confession or to its form of government. They were not called, tried, or ordained to any office in the church, and yet they were empowered to sit as the sole judges in all cases arising in the church. Further, they were authorized to send delegates to the presbytery with power to sit and act on all questions that might come before the body. Baird analyzes the reason, and this is interesting to think about. How in the world could the Presbyterian General Assembly in 1801 agree to that? I don't think it would get by any of our General Assemblies today, PCA or OPC, or any of us. I think we would have people quick enough to say, wait, that's unconstitutional. Baird says, For the fathers of our church, having so recently been accustomed to see the General Synod exercise powers unrestricted by a constitution. And you know, I hadn't realized it. Apparently, other than the adopting act of the confession and catechisms, they did not have a formal book of church order that was really set as a constitution that was binding upon them prior to the assembly. And in 1789. And so his conclusion is because they had been living so unrestricted by a constitution, were not able to realize that the General Assembly was bound to conform to the provisions of the Constitution, which the Church, through the General Synod, had established for her own protection and the ordering of all her courts, higher and lower. Baird goes on to comment the imprudence of allowing such a breach in her walls as that involved in the plan of union might have been expected to arrest a more prompt attention and secure its rejection. But the assembly was seduced by the siren of union and peace. In other words, here are good causes. We want these causes. We want not to have fighting on the frontier between churchmen as they arrive there in the first groups. And so he's saying that they were seduced by that. The plan was adopted and the way was prepared for the corrupting the doctrines of the church, the utter defacing of her order, and the introduction of protracted controversy and strife and final schism. B.M. Palmer, who was the first moderator of the Southern Church, also has a pertinent warning for us, and I think as we try to draw lessons from history, he makes a good statement. And when he says, history does not afford a better illustration of the evil wrought by good men whenever from motives of policy they swerve from principle. Their virtue lends a sanction to their schemes, while it does not stop the fatal results. This agreement was not only established by good men, but it originated in the sweetest and most godly intentions. What more Christian object could be proposed than to facilitate a union between those discordant elements? You see, he's saying that here you have an example of the effect, the ultimate effect of this was really a schism in the Presbyterian Church. And we need to be very cautious about getting into that kind of thing as we face decisions of this sort. Now, the result of the plan, Western New York and Ohio, a number of churches were of mixed character allowed by the plan. Once established, these remained, even when the population had grown to the point where both Presbyterian and Congregational churches could have been established side by side. There should have been some natural way to have moved from the temporary measure back to the standard ecclesiastical polity. That's what they should have had. In other words, until you go to such and such a size, you'll do this way. When you get to this size, then you ought to decide to separate or come in under one fold or the other. But they continued the mixed sort of things. Now, let me point out, without tracing this with great length, one of the things that came out of New England in particular was the voluntary societies. And that's the very thing we're still faced with, parachurch organizations to this day. The congregational churches did not have, you see, a denomination that really did the mission work. But they had the various different societies for mission work and for education and so forth. And the New School Brethren, trying to have good mission work and good education and so forth, were thwarted the old school brethren, the old school brethren trying to have it in the Presbyterian system. The new school brethren thwarted them and substituted the voluntary societies. Ashbel Green on the next page 4, who was here in Philadelphia, proposed that there be an assembly committee on education and candidates for the ministry. One of the results of this request was the establishment of the Assembly Seminary at Princeton. With the concurrent development at this time of the Hopkinsian doctrines in New England, there was dissatisfaction with Princeton. And thus in 1815, the American Education Society was organized in Boston, you see, to counteract the Presbyterian Committee on Education. With the efforts of the assembly to establish a board of education in 1818, a parallel society was established in New York, which refused to cooperate in the erection of an assembly board. The design of the New York board was to direct the candidates for the ministry to the New England seminaries and not to Princeton. Baird quotes a final review of the Philadelphia board. Let me skip on down past that. The last paragraph, same thing happened in foreign missions. A board for foreign missions was formed with the Dutch Reformed Church and the Associate Reformed Churches in 1817. An independent board called the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, which was a voluntary society, operated in direct competition with the Presbyterian Board. Eventually, the church merged its board with the ABCFM, thus losing any church control for its foreign missions. From this brief survey, it can be seen that voluntary societies were carrying out much of the work that belongs to the church as the church. In fact, the church had abandoned its privilege and responsibility in the area of foreign missions. Its own work of education was being undermined by the voluntary societies, which refused to cooperate with the assembly's education programs due to a difference in theology. Now, the J. Breckinridge helped to frame this memorial, and I've given the basic text of that. Then in 1837, again, a memorial was presented to the assembly, and I've again given the basic text of this on pages 9 and 10. And the assembly adopted. That was the old school dominated assembly that finally said, these churches that have been so formed are all formed unconstitutionally and are no longer part of the Presbyterian Church. They simply put out all of Western New York, all of the Northwest Territory. Now, you know, as you look at that, you might say, that's rash, harsh sort of thing. I think it took courage, tremendous courage, for an assembly to cut off a third or more of its church. They recognized they could not control this thing. The only way to control it was to get things back under the Constitution. And they simply extended it. Now, one of the interesting things that happens in Mississippi, one of the colleges in the earlier paper that I mentioned was Mississippi College, established by Presbyterians. Mississippi College had a president who was old school in his convictions. But that presbytery split over the issue, not because of doctrine, but because of fear of central authority. See, this was moving towards the time of the war between the states. And that was becoming the thing that they feared, the central authority of the federal government, and they didn't like to see it in the church government either. And so half of that presbytery, the Clinton Presbytery, split off, and you lost Mississippi College because Mount Salis Church at Clinton went new school, and nobody there to support that college. They gave it to the state, and the state said, we don't have the funds to keep this college going. They gave it to the Baptists, and now it's a thriving Baptist college. But it's a sad thing that we lost that institution that way because of that. But Trice Thompson, who was a liberal and would like to have said these people were liberals in their theology, said they weren't liberals in their theology. It was the philosophy of a central authority doing a thing like this that they just opposed. Now, there was a new school church established in the South. The only place where new schoolism got established with any degree of understanding in the South was around Greenville, Tennessee, which is East Tennessee, but more particularly the school you'd know now as Maryville College. A man named Hezekiah Balch, B-A-L-C-H, had gone to New England, had become enamored of Hopkins' theology, carried it back, was rebuked by his presbytery. He repented of it, but as soon as he got to teaching again, began to teach it again, and became ingrained in that particular area. That's the only place where new schoolism really got established in the South. In the middle of the war between the states, these two branches came together again. The new school joined the old school church in the South, but they joined it on terms of the old school. It was such a small group. They didn't have any particular bargaining power, and Dabney and Palmer, by the way, argued over it. Palmer said, it's not good principle for us to receive those brethren the way you want it to do. And Dabney said, I want to see them squelched. I want to see us receive them and to kill it before they get a seminary started in the South. It'll be a new school. And in effect, that's what happened, that they were basically put down. Now, on pages 10, 11, and 12, and 13, and top of 14, I have given the 16 points that the old school assembly in your left-hand column said were the sins of the new school people. The new school in the Auburn Declaration later that summer, and I put in the right-hand column, their responses. Basically, they sound very much, they're very acceptable to us. I think you would not find many of those all that far off. They did not acknowledge what the old school was saying about them. Now that's, you see, George Marsden has said that the new school in 1837 was not a modernist church, as we tend to identify it with as modernism. We tend to say that was the 18th or 19th century modernism. Marsden thinks it's more of the looser, broad evangelicalism. He suggests, and I'm not sure that all of you would, who were part of that background, would want necessarily to agree with him. He suggests that the Bible Presbyterian split from the OPs was new school as opposed to old. I think what's really closer to it today is the Evangelical Presbyterian Church. See, I think they are nearer to the new school kind of thinking. Then, but I don't know all about the McIntyre movement. Maybe McIntyre is less of a Calvinist than I think he is. But my feeling has been the Bible Presbyterian Church has been a Presbyterian church, not just an evangelical church. But the Evangelical Presbyterian Church of recent days, that is, that new Evangelical Presbyterian Church, as they call themselves, are, you know, they're charismatic, they allow that, they have women officers. They're that broad. It's that sort of mentality that seems to me is really what is new school mentality of today, rather than so much the mentality of, say, the Bible Presbyterians or the RPCES. I would not want to brand my former RPCES brethren as being new school, although George Marsden does. I don't think that Marsden in his book, by the way, warns us sufficiently of the danger. You see, I think the danger of the new school was their looser view allowed them to establish a Union Seminary in New York, which produced a Briggs, which produced modernism in the worst forms in this country. An Auburn Seminary, in other words, they having opened the door to a looser view, it just let all sorts of things come in. I don't think they were modernist of the same sense of our 20th century, but I do think what the new school view, and one of the things that happens, you see, in the union with the north, in the north between the old and new school in 1869, was that they united on terms of agreement that both views are allowed. And you have only Princeton holding out as only the old school seminary. All the rest of them had mixed views. And only Princeton held out till 1929, you see, and in the PCUSA. Because you had wedded into that church, those allowance for a looser view, which developed into liberalism and modernism of an evil denying sort of Unitarianism in the church. John Clellan said when he left in 1936, when the church becomes Unitarian in its doctrine, Roman Catholic in its polity, it's time to leave. I think that is true, no doubt. I've said a few remarks about Marsden at the end and the conclusion. My time is up, and I appreciate your bearing with me and trying to assimilate as much material as I've had. Two big subjects, either one of them could have been used just for the 1 hour, but I've tried to do my assignment, Mr. Logan, and I trust that it'll be satisfactory to you.